This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. If you think of the picture postcard Vermont village, one of the most important features is a white church with a steeple rising up from the valley. And it's true, a lot of Vermont towns have what used to be a community church, or maybe now have a couple of churches dotting the landscape. But some of the old churches have fallen out of regular use and are starting to deteriorate. Various groups have sprung up to preserve this important part of Vermont architecture. Often that involves fixing those impressive spires. That's a steeplejack's job. Jay Southgate is the owner of Southgate Steeplejacks in Barrie.
When I was younger, I loved to do woodworking and just sweat individual joints, maybe spend a day cutting dovetail joints on a drawer or something like that. And it's funny, as I've gotten older, I've lost my interest in that kind of small, meticulous thing. And this may sound like a cop-out, but they're 80 feet up in the air. So how they look from 10 feet away doesn't really matter. And if you're allowed to take some liberties with how good they look up close, you can take steps to make sure they endure. So I care about doing what's going to make it endure.
Southgate is currently working on restoring the steeple of Burlington's College Street Congregational Church. That church was burned by an arsonist a few years ago, and the spire will be replaced in August. Today on the program, we're going to spend some time looking at Vermont's church architecture. And I'm joined in the studio by Glenn Andrus, a professor emeritus of architecture at Middlebury College and co-author of Buildings of Vermont. Glenn, it's a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And by Paul Bruhn, Executive Director of the Preservation Trust of Vermont. Paul, nice to talk with you as always.
Nice to be here.
So how true is this idea of a white clapboard church in the middle of a village with the spire rising above that anybody can see as they descend into the valley and enter that village, and it being sort of the key architectural feature of a Vermont village? Is that really true, Glenn?
I think it's absolutely true.
It is?
It's an iconic part of the Vermont landscape are small villages punctuated by those white spires. And it brings to mind, in fact, two of my favorite paintings of Vermont. One is by the Hudson River painter Kensett. It's in the Middlebury College Museum of Art, which is a view of Rutland down the Otter Valley. And you see the mountains in the background. You see the woods in the foreground. And there are the spires of Rutland. And that's the only clue that you have that Rutland's in that landscape. And then there's this wonderful view of Stowe Village, kind of a bird's eye view, looking down. And there's the Union Church thrown up against the mountains. This is, I think, everybody's image of Vermont.
And Professor Andrus, is it always sort of the same style, at least in our heads, of this white church with the steeple of a certain architectural style?
Well, yes and no. The massing tends to be that way. But then as you move up closer, there's a huge variety. And we have this stereotypical view of what it ought to be. But they cover the full range of architectural styles. And when Curtis Johnson and I were doing the book on Vermont architecture, maybe 20% of the buildings in there are churches. We had to leave a lot on the cutting room floor. But you could write an entire book just about Vermont's churches, making important statements about architecture nationally, about how Vermont has followed every one of the styles in American history, about important builders, and about the history of Vermont itself, the progression of our society by looking at these buildings.
So, Paul Bruhn, do you think of sort of native styles, native architecture through the eras as moving through, you know, as Vermont progressed?
Glenn can talk more about that. What I guess I might add to what Glenn just suggested was that it's also a difference in materials. It's not just white churches. There are a lot of brick churches and stone churches in the state. And just to add a bit about the spire question is that one of my favorites is driving down Route 7 toward Brandon. And they're now
we're in Addison County now.
What? Yeah, and we're coming into the village of Brandon, and there is this beautiful spire that rises above and announces the community. It was lost years ago in a hurricane. I don't know whether it was the 1938 hurricane or the 20s. Or the 20s. It was quite a while ago, I think. But maybe it was the 50s. In any event, it was gone. And a group of people, led by a wonderful woman by the name of Beth Carnes, who kind of rallied the community to rebuild that and restore that steeple to the community. And now it is what announces Brandon as you drive south on Route 7.
So you're heading now through – you go through Addison County, you head into Rutland County, yep. You hit Brandon, and you know yep. You've hit it because you see that spire.
Absolutely. It's a beautiful sight.
Go ahead,
Glenn. I'm sorry. And it's a case study in the fact that this is a community that rallied around a very small congregation who could not afford to put that back. But these on the advisory council, for instance, for historic preservation, when we talk about grants, we talk about the public benefit of a project. And there is huge public benefit to the preservation of these landmarks, not just for the people who use that building weekly, but for the whole community.
Why?
These are among the most ambitious buildings that were ever built by their communities in Vermont. They are among the most beautiful buildings that we possess, and they're part of our general cultural heritage, and they speak of much more than just a narrow denomination. And that landmark in Brandon just raises people's spirits. And it's important, too, I think, to Vermont's state image, which is very important to our economy. You know, people have a sense of what Vermont is all about, and the conservation of these buildings is a very important aspect of that.
But Paul Bruhn, as we know from Vermont Edition shows in the past and from Pew studies that prove that Vermont and New Hampshire are together the least religious in terms of organized religion in the country, do you agree with Professor Andrus that it is still important to have these symbols that are symbols of houses of worship? I mean, they tell us about and they signal worship and religion and congregating in a certain way. Do you think they're still important?
Absolutely. And it's not just the religious aspect. It is about these buildings being community-defining buildings, like the Brandon Baptist Church that we talked about a little earlier, like the townhouse in Stratford, for example, that sits up on a little hill and dominates the community. And what I think we're finding is that there are new uses that churches can be put to if a congregation dwindles to the point of not being able to maintain their buildings. It's not our first choice. We love to have churches succeed and sacred places in Vermont succeed. But if they're facing big challenges, there are other ways in which these magnificent buildings can be put to use.
We got a note from a listener who goes by House Crow, who says, "I love the little brick Catholic church in Shelburne, St. Catherine of Siena. It doesn't just look like a random building like many Catholic churches built since the 1960s, and it doesn't look like a Protestant church." There's nothing wrong with Protestant churches, House Crow makes the point to say. "It looks a lot like an old world church that could have been there for centuries." And I want to invite other listeners, if you have a particular church, a particular building of worship that seems really iconic to you or that is curious to you that you want to mention and maybe ask about, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a question or a picture on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Are either of you familiar with that church, the Catholic Church
yes.
in Gillette?
This brings up a point, and that is that there are certain aspects of these churches that really speak of their denominations, and that's one of the things that make them such an interesting cultural expression of Vermont. For instance, okay, we know the Congregationalists and their white-framed federal-style churches. Well, beginning in the 1820s, there was a move to build Episcopal churches in Vermont, and they were looking for a different image. They didn't want to look like the Baptists or the Congregationalists. And Benjamin Bosworth Smith, who was the rector of a struggling little Episcopal church in Middlebury, and actually was the patron for the construction of the first Gothic Revival church in Vermont, published a national newsletter saying that the only suitable style for the Anglican Church in America was the English Gothic Revival, English stone Gothic churches. He went on to become Bishop of Kentucky, and then he went on to become the presiding bishop in Washington. And he spurred the association of the Episcopal Church with Gothic. The first Episcopal bishop, Bishop Hopkins in Burlington, published America's first book on Gothic architecture in Burlington in 1838. He not only sponsored that kind of style, but he also designed several buildings, including churches in Rutland and in Brandon. And then he went on to become national presiding bishop. So that right there, Vermont made a very important statement in a national style. Methodist churches tended to have two doors rather than three.
Why?
I guess it's the men and the women entering in the different doors, but it became the standard where it identified Methodist churches. And we find these little variations. The Roman Catholic Archdiocese had favorite architects. There were a series of them who designed whole sets of churches across the state that you spot them and you know immediately that these are Roman Catholic churches.
But Paul Brunner, it's no longer true even in churches that you may be able to identify from when they were built as what type of congregation was building them. It's no longer true that you can assume that that is still the congregation that's using this church. We've seen over time many different congregations fill the pews at these buildings in sort of a cyclical way. Is that just down to hard times for various congregations?
Well, I think it speaks to the point that you made a little earlier that about Vermont and New Hampshire, that were pretty secular communities. And so I think that results in sort of the next step in the history of a church, that if the congregation isn't able to make it, then the next choice is often the transition to another religious preference. And that has happened many times in Vermont, and sometimes it's a variation. Like in East Pulteney, there's a magnificent early church on the green, and it was a Baptist church, but they were really struggling. And so a Southern Baptist group came to Vermont and has taken over that church and have built a very large congregation.
Can you tell me about some of your favorite architects and maybe a story about a church architect in Vermont, Glenn Andrus?
Oh, okay. Well, one of my very favorites is a man named Lavius Fillmore, who was a master builder who came up from Connecticut. And his cousins had settled in Bennington. And after he did a couple landmark churches in Connecticut, actually so close in their ideas to ideas of the great architect Charles Bulfinch out of Boston. He was such a close interpreter of some of Bulfinch's ideas that it's almost as if he trained under Bulfinch. He came to Bennington and built Old First Church in Bennington, 1804-1805. And Middlebury at that time had been struggling to build a meeting house. They had battled for 20 years over where it ought to be located, and so they were still meeting in barns in Middlebury, even though they had a college and mansions and mills and a female academy and everything. They had no church. And when Middlebury Village ultimately gained enough population that it could outvote the rest of the town, they voted that the church would be placed in Middlebury Village, and its patron, Gamaliel Painter, decided that he had to have Fillmore. He snapped up Fillmore, brought him to Middlebury, sold him some mills to keep him there, and gave him a bigger budget than Bennington. And it was a race between Bennington and Middlebury for the most elegant church. And the way that they could make Middlebury more elegant was to spend a lot more money on their church tower. And so we have one of the finest Federal-style church towers in New England at the head of Main Street in Middlebury.
And that's thanks to the congregation wanting.
Oh, obviously. I mean, this is one-upmanship all the way. but then there's George Guernsey, who's a Montpelier architect and builder. And he built 18 churches around Vermont in the 1870s and 1880s. There are some in brick. There's some in frame. East Orange, for example, is a lovely little frame church. Some of them are in marble. They are all striking in their use of tall spires, beautiful use of materials, craftsmanship. Some of the Roman Catholic churches that he designed, for instance, the Immaculate Heart of Mary in Rutland, incredible use of marble work. And, of course, that's tapping into the Rutland marble workers' tradition, so that here's a church that's an expression of the prime industry in town. But wherever his hand was, we have a striking church. And they aren't the white churches that everyone thinks of, as Paul says. They're in brick. They're in stone. And we shouldn't overlook these Victorian churches, because they're some of the most marvelous buildings we've got in the state.
We are talking about Vermont's churches, the history of Vermont's churches, and moves to preserve them. We got a note from Levi in Shoreham who says the marble churches of Proctor are an impressive sight. Another throw there to the industry in the town and the materials in the area that people were using and wanted to be able to use in their churches. If you'd like to share a picture of your favorite local church, you can do it on our Facebook page, or you can call with a question, 1-800-639-2211. When we come back, we're going to talk with a member of the Upright Steeple Society, which is restoring a church in Linden. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're talking about Vermont's church architecture with Glenn Andrus, a professor emeritus of architecture at Middlebury College and co-author of Buildings of Vermont, and with Paul Brune, executive director of the Preservation Trust of Vermont. You can call 1-800-639-2211 with your question. Again, that's 1-800-639-2211, or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We've been looking at some of the ways old churches are still a fixture in their communities. Many of these old churches, though, definitely need some help to be preserved if they're going to stick around for another century. In Linden, a group called the Upright Steeple Society is working hard on one church in particular. We're joined now by a member of that memorably named group, Jim Gallagher. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you, Jane.
Describe the church you're working on preserving.
At one of the classic white New England churches that your guests have described. It was constructed in 1829. It's a Greek Revival, we understand it, a Greek Revival style. And it's a beautiful, simple New England church.
How did the Upright Steeple Society come to be and to be associated with trying to preserve and repair this church?
Well, the church was built, as I say, in 1829, and the railroad came to the town of Linden in 1860s. And at that period of time, much of the population and economy shifted from Linden Corner, where our church is, to Lindenville, which is now the kind of focus of the town of Linden. And as it as the population shifted, membership declined. Maintenance declined, and over the decades, the church went from beautiful to not so beautiful to sad to jeopardized. And early 2009, three of the remaining parishioners of the Congregational Church called a public meeting to try and deal with the problem, and about 50 area residents attended, and the upshot of the meeting was that we agreed to form a non-sectarian, non-profit corporation, symbolically named the Upright Steeple Society, because among other structural deficiencies, the steeple was leaning dangerously to the south. We got 501c3 tax exempt recognition, and started on what now has been a 7-year effort to restore this ancient, well, historic building.
And it's cost a couple $100,000 to do it. And, you know, as you sort of alluded to, you're not even a member of this congregation, which has dwindled down to 2 members. So why is it so important to preserve it?
Well, it was a focus of the town of Linden. Linden Corner was the active part of it was the center of the town of Linden in the old days, and this was the center of that that geographical area and of that cultural area. It's kind of sandwiched in by a couple of old covered bridges. It's just a beautiful a little brook runs through it. It's a beautiful historic area, and this building is kind of the key to it. And I would drive by it every day on my way to work, and kind of feel bad about it and say somebody ought to do something about that. And then the members called a meeting, and I attended, and all of us did do something about it.
And it's almost done.
It's, I would say it's 80%+ done. It's, a couple of years ago, crossed the line between phase one, phase two. We got it structurally repaired. We, got, a new roof on it. We got the, timber repaired that was causing the steeple to lean. We jacked it, excavated, got drainage in, concrete foundation, concrete floors. In the basement, new columns to support the south end of the steeple, new sheetrock walls, a new tongue and groove ceiling, and just the past few weeks, we have a new southern yellow pine floor, new heating units in there. It really looks now lovely on the inside. It still needs to be scraped and painted on the outside, but it's structurally sound, and on the inside, it's just beautiful.
Jim Gallagher is a member of the Upright Steeple Society. The group has been working, as he was telling us, to preserve a Greek revivalist church in Linden. Thank you for sharing your story with us.
Thank you.
And let's go to Jack, calling in from Colchester. Hi, Jack. Go right ahead.
Yes, I'd like to mention a wonderful 19th century red brick church in Winooski, Vermont. This is St. Francis Xavier. Those of us who have flown into Burlington Airport know it, the twin spires, the twin red brick spires of St. Francis Xavier. Inside, beautiful murals and towering stained glass windows telling Bible stories. It's a real gem, whether you're a Catholic or not, to just go in and take a look at this majestic building.
Jack, thanks for your call. Appreciate it. Let's hear from Paul in Manchester. Hi, Paul. Your thoughts?
Hi.
Hi.
I'm just wondering, are there any notable synagogues that you can think of in the state of Vermont? Paul. Being a Jewish guy, I ask.
Yeah, thanks for your question. Okay, so Glenn Andres and Paul Bruin, notable synagogues.
Yes, we have two of them in Burlington. We have what is considered one of the oldest synagogues, extant synagogues, in the country. Ohavi Zadik Synagogue has recently carried out a fabulous project to save and restore a shul.
Yeah,
maybe
a beautiful big mural.
Paul could talk about this. This is nationally important, internationally important.
Yes, and actually I went and went to Ojavi Zedek and talked with them about this incredible Shul mural that they've preserved and put up right in the big foyer of Ojavi Zedek. And we're going to put a link to that on our Facebook page so people can listen to that story and see this mural, because it has been a pretty amazing restoration project. You're absolutely right. So a couple of important synagogues there. I want to take one more call, and then we're going to come back to both of you. Hal is on the line with us from Rutland. Hi, Hal. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. I'm calling concerning a church just north of Chester. I don't know what denomination, but I've been there, and they have a brochure that describes the construction as Schnecht Ashlier, which I think translates from I don't know what language has locally quarried rock, and I'm wondering if you're familiar with it.
Yes.
I'm getting nods from both our guests.
Stone Village in Chester. And actually, the whole village is built almost with Schnecht Ashlier, which is a special Scottish form of masonry that's very rare in the United States, but it came in with some Scottish masons who were brought in to build mills. And then they went on to develop this whole village. So we have houses as well as the church all worked up in this special, very easily identifiable masonry.
Paul Bruhn, we heard from Jim Gallagher a few minutes ago talking about this church in Linden that he said, look, it was just important to preserve this. It's important to the town. It's an important historical piece. And it's important to sort of symbolism and to coming together. But it also costs hundreds of thousands of dollars. So how are churches being preserved when congregations can't usually afford to do that preservation work? And often towns struggle to come up with funding if they're going to take it on as a sort of community resource.
Well, it's amazing how much perseverance exists in Vermont. And people find a way. It's really quite remarkable. But it often takes many years, and Jim talked about the phases that they have gone through with the work on the Linden Church.
Yeah, he said it's been 7 years that they've been working on it.
We actually helped them get going. We provided a small grant to do a assessment of the building, as well as develop a plan for the restoration that would be phased over a bunch of years. And that's how it's played out. You know, we're able to raise money to get phase one done, and having succeeded at that, they were able to raise money for the next phases of the rehabilitation process. And that's how it works in most communities. And it takes a long time, but there's a lot of perseverance by community members. And I think it's also about a recognition of communities that these buildings are more than places of worship. Most churches provide a whole variety of very important services to the community, whether it's space for a daycare center or meeting space for AA or community members. There's a wide variety of services that churches provide to the community. And because of that, because of the role that they play in the community, non-church members step up and support the work that needs to be done on these buildings.
We got a note from Marnie in Middlebury who says, please ask Professor Andrus about the small West Salisbury church building and its windows. It hasn't operated as a church for years and years, but the number of windows, plain glass panes, are incredible. Marnie says, I was married in that church more than 20 years ago, and it is so plain and simple but glorious.
It's a perfectly wonderful little church that has been deconsecrated, and in fact, it's privately owned. It reverted to the landowner the land that had originally been given for it. But people have maintained it over the years, and it is a wonderful space. I've been in there for a Christmas carol sing, very cold, no heat, but it takes you right back to early days of Vermont. Yes.
If each of you had to choose one church to direct our listeners to go visit, you know, if they're on a road trip through Vermont, tell us one church that you think is really worth having a look at.
Let me answer that in a way that you didn't expect me to answer.
All right, Paul.
Because I'd like to focus on just for a second about redundant churches, churches that no longer are able to be reused or used for their original purpose. And there's one fabulous one that has just about been completed, and that's in Putney, a former congregational church that the Putney Historical Society and Next Stage Arts have rehabilitated and are turning it into an absolutely fabulous performing arts facility. It is magnificent. They have done a really, really superb job. And the building will continue to be used for community suppers and other community gatherings on the first floor. But the second floor is this amazing performing arts space that is worth a look.
And I only left you about 10 seconds, Professor Andrus.
Old West Church in Callis, 1825. Over the high pulpit, they have stenciled letters, remove not the ancient landmark that thy fathers have set. And I think that becomes really a good motto for anybody who's interested in these wonderful buildings.
And that,
that one
is open 24 hours a day, every day of the year.
Good. So you can go in anytime,
even if
you're on a late night road trip. Glenn Andrus is a professor emeritus of architecture at Middlebury College and co-author of Buildings of Vermont. Paul Bruhn is executive director of the Preservation Trust of Vermont. Thanks very much to both of you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Author Steve Long joined us on the show not long ago to discuss his new book about a devastating storm in New England history. On September 21, 1938, a hurricane slammed into New England, killing hundreds. It had long-lasting effects on the economy and the landscape itself. In Vermont, most of the damage was to forests and trees. On the show, Long described how witnesses reacted to the scene.
You'd have forests that had been 80-foot tall trees. Suddenly, all of the mass of that forest is within 10 feet of the ground. It's just a vertical forest has become horizontal. And it was just stunning to people.
That great New England hurricane 78 years ago is still in the living memory of some people in our region who were children at the time, and for many more whose family stories were passed down through generations. So many of you contacted us with stories about the hurricane of 38 that we wanted to revisit the event, and today we're going to share some of the stories we were told. Our executive producer, Patty Daniels, joins me to help with that. Hi, Patty.
Hi, Jane. We're going to start with Allison in South Burlington. She was 3 years old in 1938, and her family lived in Massachusetts. This is her story of the storm.
My father was a manager at New England Telephone Company in Boston, and we lived in the suburb, Braintree. And the day of the hurricane, which of course no one knew was coming, my mother was planning to leave me with under the care of my great-grandmother and take the train into Boston and have dinner with my father in town. So she walked down to the train station, and as she waited for the train, she said she never saw the sky turn this green color before. And she thought, I just better go home and not go into Boston. So she went home, and the hurricane came. And I remember her holding me in her arms, and we watched trees flipping, just gyrating crazily in this incredible storm. Then the lights went out, of course, and it turned out we didn't get power back for about 10 days. And my father, we didn't see him for several days because you can imagine what the storm had done to telephone poles and people's telephone service. So he was trying to manage all this.
And Allison says her mother was planning her aunt's wedding at the time. It was supposed to be about 10 days after that storm. Allison says the backup plan was a candlelit ceremony, but the electricity came back just in time for the wedding.
A miracle. Elizabeth wrote to us, quite a few years ago, friends of mine living on a hillside in Braintree, Vermont, got out some old photos, including those showing the damage from the 38 hurricane. In 1938, the Braintree hillsides were heavily wooded. The photo of the hills on the other side of the road showed every single tree down. Even looking at a small black and white photo, it was clear what a disaster the hurricane was.
And Mary Lou was a 7-year-old living in a Boston suburb, and she has a very kid-centric memory of when the storm hit. She says, When we realized there was lots of wind, my sister and I tried to fly with umbrellas by jumping off the front porch steps. Needless to say, all we did was turn our umbrellas inside out. It wasn't until later that my parents found out how bad the storm was. The next morning, there were trees and wires down all over the streets, and that meant no school, which happened to be my sister's 10th birthday. I think they're counting that as another storm victory. She says, our backyard was connected to a home with a driveway lined with poplars. Every single one went down like 10 pins.
We also heard kind of a similar story or similar theme from Peter in Brattleboro, who shared this.
I'm not telling from memory. I'm telling from what my parents told me. See, I was 3 years old, and I learned later as I grew up what I did in the hurricane. They told me it happened at School Street in Salem, New Hampshire, that I was actually out in the hurricane, and I was walking up toward the house, and they told me they could see me out the windows, side windows of our house, and the wind was so strong that I was bent over almost horizontal. The thing that I thought was remarkable about the story, for what it's worth, is that, what would a parent be doing standing inside the house looking out the window at a three-year-old walking up the hill or pushing, struggling up the hill in a hurricane? Today, we might call that neglect. You know, before Dr. Spock wrote his book, parents just didn't worry as much about children as they did afterwards.
I mean, I'd like to think that Jim's parents have a different version of telling that story. In our interview with Steve Long, he described how the shape of the land itself was scarred and changed by the hurricane of 38. And Jim in Waterbury Center thinks he remembers the storm, but he says the lasting effects, at least in his part of Vermont, weren't as noticeable.
I was 18 months old, and I was just sitting in a little chair on the front porch of my parents' farmhouse, and it was very, very windy and stormy. I remember that. But I think that this area that we lived in, which was Middlesex Center, did not receive the full brunt of the storm, because later on, as I grew up, I started working in the woods with my father up till I was about 10 years old. And I saw very little evidence of damage there. We were cutting trees and for lumber and firewood, and just there was not a lot of apparent damage. So I think Middlesex Center maybe missed the brunt of the storm. And I know that a lot of people experienced severe problems with it. We did not. Farmhouse is still standing here, as a matter of fact, today, although we moved out of there in 1947.
And Nancy in Danville sent us this piece of family history. I'm enclosing a photo of my grandfather, Raymond Laporte, taken in 1938. He worked for the water department in Providence, Rhode Island, and this picture appears in a book about the hurricane, pointing out the watermark for downtown Providence. He was about 6 feet, 1 inch tall, and the watermark was over his hat. Eventually, they put a plaque up on the building downtown where my grandfather stood.
So Nancy also sent us another photo of her mom standing at that same place many, many years later next to the plaque. We're going to post her photos and several more stories that we heard from you of family memories of this hurricane. So check our Facebook page this afternoon or go online to vpr.net.
And thanks to our intern, Anna St. Maria, senior at St. Michael's College, who produced this segment. Tomorrow, we're bringing it back to the present day. It's our annual start of the season baseball show, a chance to look at the hopes and dreams of Red Sox and Yankees fans and to examine what the teams have done in the offseason to improve their chances of winning this year. We've got a panel of fans and sports writers, and they'll take your projections and prognostications right to Vermont Edition at vpr.net and tune in tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri and Sam Gale Rosen, with production assistance from Anna St. Marie. Liam Connors directed the show, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. Our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.